Good morning on today's programme. The UK is planning for at least 100 additional data centres to be constructed by 2030. And, 15 years on from the Arab Spring, Tunisians are marching and even rioting once again. First to Mauritania, where thousands of refugees who are fleeing violence in Mali are sheltering in a makeshift camp in the desert. The violence between a group linked to Al-Qaeda and the Malian army with its Russian allies has escalated in recent months. Fuel tankers have been attacked and blockades have been imposed, cutting off food and supplies to entire communities. Many who are left with no choice but to flee. Caitlin Kelly now reports.
Tents and makeshift shelters stretch across the sand in eastern Mauritania, near the border with Mali. This desert now shelters thousands of refugees who fled in recent weeks as fighting intensifies against militants linked to Al-Qaeda. Fraping is tied between sticks to serve as homes. Tree branches double as storage. Many have fled without their livestock, their way of making money. There is little protection from the Sahel's punishing heat and wind. Still, refugees say it's safer than Mali. They've been fleeing escalating violence between the Al-Qaeda-linked group JNIM, the Malian army, and its Russian allies, the Afrika Korps. They say they've become trapped between warring sides. Like Fadimata, who fled her village in fear a week ago, said, "On one side of us were the jihadists and on the other side were Russians." Mali has been fighting an insurgency for more than a decade. In 2021, a military junta seized power and ordered French and United Nations forces to leave the country. Analysts say that withdrawal created a security vacuum, allowing armed groups to expand across rural areas. The Sahel, a vast belt of arid land stretching across Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, has now become a major front for armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. The junta has since leaned heavily on Russian forces. First the mercenary group Wagner, and now Afrika Korps, a military unit under direct command of the Kremlin. All in the name of fighting terrorism. Fatoumata says the Russians took what they could and burned the rest. Fleeing with her children on her back, she says she ran for her life. On the long journey to Mauritania, she says she was so thirsty she thought her heart might stop. At the same time, JNIM has intensified its campaign. Since September, the group has attacked fuel tankers and imposed blockades, cutting off food and supplies to entire communities and even restricting access to the capital, Bamako. Families who fled say they were given ultimatums: leave within days or be treated as the enemy. Dozens of refugees describe atrocities on both sides, such as mass killing, sexual assault, and kidnapping. Inside a shaded tent in Fatoumata's new village in Mauritania, on a sweltering afternoon in the Saharan heat, dozens of women gather to learn something simple: how to breathe. The sessions are part of an EU-funded program offering breathing exercises, sewing activities, and safe spaces to talk. Small interventions aimed at easing severe anxiety after months or even years of violence. The women say it helps the day-to-day things, but their trauma still runs deep. Many describe watching loved ones killed before their eyes. Some say they witnessed beheadings and other brutal acts. Others fled drone strikes and ground assaults carried out during joint operations by the Malian army and its Russian allies. Local caseworkers say they can only spend about 5 weeks in each village before moving across this vast region along the Malian border, despite the overwhelming need. Mauritania, they say, has just 6 qualified psychologists nationwide, even as the refugee population in this region alone numbers in the hundreds of thousands. Fadi also fled Mali. Sitting in her new home between two sticks, she pours tea and describes how JNIM ordered her village to leave within 72 hours. She said they fled fearing for their life without taking anything, and now they live without clothes or blankets. The past decade in this region has been marked by military rule, foreign mercenaries, and mass displacement. Since 2012, more than 3 million people have been forced from their homes. According to analysts, what began as fights against insurgents more than a decade ago has become a broader crisis, which has intensified and increasingly been brutalized. As families are fleeing for the second or even third time in a decade, many now believe Mali is at its most critical point since 2012, and its civilians are paying the highest price. This is Caitlin Kelly for World Report from Douankara, Mauritania.
The UK is planning a huge expansion in the number of data storage centres operating in the country. At least 100 new ones are to be constructed by 2030 to run artificial intelligence. The British government wants to build more digital processing hubs to copper fasten the country's place as the third largest in the global market, after the US and Germany. But will the operation of so many new data processing centres be sustainable, since they will use much more electricity and water to cool them? As Russell Padmore reports.
We're becoming more reliant on these giant warehouses stacked with computers to keep up with our growing demand for services like streaming movies, social media, and online banking. The growth of artificial intelligence means the need for more computer storage, and therefore more power-hungry data processing hubs, which also need water to cool them. The UK is already struggling to generate enough electricity, especially from green sources like solar and wind, so a huge increase in the number of data storage centres will stretch power supplies. Ireland faces a similar challenge as global technology companies build more of these facilities using so much power when consumers face rising energy bills. Ireland has about 90 data storage facilities compared to 477 operating in the UK, a figure which is set to rise significantly here within 5 years. But should global technology companies be forced to generate their own power rather than draining the national grid? The investment bank Goldman Sachs has forecast that by 2030, the amount of electricity needed to run data centres across the world will rise by 175% compared to 2023. The company also predicts that artificial intelligence will take up to 30% of storage capacity within 2 years. That takes away digital space we currently use to store records of our online banking or family photographs. In the United States, companies like Amazon and Microsoft have realized using more electricity from the grid doesn't help their environmentally friendly image, so they're planning to use nuclear power. They're investing in small modular reactors to generate electricity. Here in the UK, the government is struggling to revive the nation's stalled economy, so the politicians want to ride the AI wave. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, believes artificial intelligence will drive incredible change, from teachers personalising lessons, small businesses with record keeping, to speeding up planning applications, he said. The British government plans to limit the power of environmental campaigners to block new infrastructure developments, so it may get tougher to challenge the construction of data centres. A few months ago, hundreds of residents living close to the site of a planned data centre in Hertfordshire, close to London, were dismayed when the local council dismissed objections to a plan for a computer storage hub to be built on 85 acres of green belt land. Data storage centres need to be cooled, using vast quantities of water, a worry for areas of the UK where drought is common during the summer. A medium-sized computer storage hub can use millions of gallons of water a day. More than half of the new data centres, scheduled to be in operation by 2030, will be in the region around London. But the American investment group Blackstone plans to build a giant one in Blyth near Newcastle in the northeast. It'll be the size of several large shopping centres, ironically on the site of a former power station. Construction, which is due to start in 2031, will take 3 years. About 100 planning applications have been lodged to build new data storage centres here in the UK. The government believes the growing use of artificial intelligence will drive demand for more computer processing, which should boost the British economy. But the challenge will be generating more electricity to run these digital storage facilities by expanding capacity from zero carbon sources like wind and solar. The forward march of AI is speeding up and it's already having an impact on all of us. The complex technology needs new data storage centres, and that means generating more electricity to power the banks of computer servers. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
And finally, to Tunisia, where the death of a young man has triggered riots and clashes with police in the city of Kairouan. 15 years on from the popular uprising that toppled then-president Zine Abidine Ben Ali, a movement that inspired what became known as the Arab Spring that led to a transitional democracy. Tunisians are marching and even rioting once again in protest of what they say is a return to autocracy and police impunity that they thought they'd seen the back of in 2011. Elysia Volkman has this report.
The death of a young man sparked riots and clashes with police in the city of Kairouan, home to the Great Mosque and part of Tunisia's much disfavoured and neglected interior. Naim Albariki was chased by police after running a red light, and according to his family and the Tunisian League for the Defence of Human Rights, he was savagely beaten about the head and died 2 weeks later of his injuries at Ibn al-Jazara University Hospital in Kairouan, just before the 15th anniversary of the start of the Tunisian Revolution of 2011. 18 civil society organisations have petitioned the government to open an investigation into yet another death of a young man at the hands of police. On December 17th, instead of anniversary celebrations of the revolution, large-scale protests took place in the southern coastal city of Gerbes. This too descended into violent confrontations with police, resulting in the arrest of 54 youths who have subsequently been released from custody, and one youth hospitalised with injuries to his eyes. Protesters there have been demonstrating for months demanding the closure of chemical plants that locals say have been poisoning the air of the once beautiful Oasis City. Local activists claim the chemical industry's outputs are polluting the Gulf of Gabes, causing mutations and cancer in fish stocks, and air pollution is causing breathing problems in the community, especially its more vulnerable members. Their anger is boiling as their complaints continue to be ignored by local and state authorities. Winter is traditionally marching season in Tunisia. The cold exacerbates the feeling of hardship, and for many, the only heating they can afford is their boiling anger. In the capital, Tunis, there are weekly marches in protest against what demonstrators are saying has become an intolerable and unjust regime. President Kais Saied's security services and judiciary continue to crack down on political opposition and civil society since his power grab in July of 2021. At one recent Saturday march, Shaima Issa, one of the founders of the National Salvation Front, an opposition movement that included a cross-section of political parties, activists and civil society, was arrested and then sentenced on the following Monday to 20 years of prison. Days later, two lawyers, a human rights lawyer, Ayashi Hamami, and Issam Shebi of the National Salvation Front movement, was sentenced to 5 and 18 years, respectively. Tunisia is a state party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. Both guarantee the right to freedom of expression and assembly, to fair trial, and to not be arbitrarily arrested or detained. According to Amnesty, since 2022, over 100 people, including opposition politicians, have faced unjust trials. Looking at government statistics and Tunisian news media, it would appear that Tunisia is on the up, with the opening of new mega projects and foreign debt appearing to be reduced. President Kais Saied still waging war on what he calls corruption. But Tunisian economist Ghazi Ben Ahmed told me that statistics are deceiving, with a total debt ballooning to 90% of GDP. He said food and pharmaceutical shortages are due to a lack of foreign currency reserves, and the untaxable black market makes up 40% of GDP. Ramdan Benamour, the Tunisian Forum for Economic and Social Rights, an NGO that has documented and analysed statistics relating to public protests and different forms of violence, said that poverty and lack of services is fueling discontent. He said that after what he called Kais Saied's coup d'etat in 2021, numbers of protests diminished sharply. But this year, the number of protests in Tunisia have skyrocketed from 2,638 in 2024 to 4,838 by this November. Benamour explained that at the moment, the anger is localised on local issues. In Gabes, it is focused on pollution. In Gafsa, the lack of access to transport. In Sidi Bouzid, the birthplace of the revolution, it's the lack of access to primary school education. He warns that like in December of 2010, when the fruit seller Mohamed Bouazizi was slapped in the face by a local official over a vendor's license, there will come a tipping point. That historic slap in the face provoked Bouazizi to set himself on fire in front of the local government building, and his subsequent death caused the city to erupt into weeks of violence that spread across the country until after 3 weeks of protests, fighting broke out in the capital. According to Benamour, that rather than having the revolutionary spirit being extinguished by fear and oppression, once again anger in the streets is building, and he said it could explode at any time. For World Report, I'm Alizia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.